Welcome to Beer Buzz. I'm Liz, this is Brian, and today we're here drinking with Christian from Wolves and People Farmhouse Brewery. Welcome, Christian.
Thank you.
So, I know you've done a lot of writing about beer, but how did you move from, you know, being a connoisseur and an expert on beer, if you will, to actually wanting to start your own brewery?
Connoisseur, it sounds so fancy, but I would say I had one of those kind of like epiphany moments, you know, when you're standing there and suddenly everything comes together. I was at the Great American Beer Festival 2009 and visiting for the first time. I'd never been to that. And I was just, I'd always dreamed of doing a brewery, but I didn't really know what it was going to take. But there I was, surrounded by brewers, tens of thousands of beer fans, and it just kind of hit me. I'd run into some friends from Oregon. Everyone seemed to be like having the time of their life. And I was like, I got to do this. Why am I waiting any longer? I can't let it go any longer without trying to, at least trying.
So you grew up here in Newburgh, Oregon, on a filbert nut farm that has an old farmhouse on it, which is now the location of your brewery. Did you always envision the brewery that you had to be on the farmhouse you grew up on, to live two doors down from your parents?
Good question. I would say, well, I mean, if I had a bottle of my first homebrew here, I would definitely not make you drink it because you would spit it out. But the label says Springbrook Farm on it, and I knew from that first batch that I wanted to do a brewery at our farm. I didn't know that I would do it inside our barn. There's a 100-year-old Craftsman barn that's kind of leaning over, amazing old building. I didn't realize that until many years later, that it could actually be inside the barn. I thought maybe somewhere on the farm we'd, you know, build something fancy. And I did these, you know, corny drawings of a big factory and imagining like this modern brewery. But when I went to Belgium in 96 and 97, spring of 97, I should say, that's when I visited the first real farmhouse breweries I went to in my life, and kind of had the realization that, wait, we could do this not only on the farm, but in our old barn.
So. Yeah, because you actually have a farmhouse, so cheers to that.
Cheers. Oh, yeah. I'm into that.
So when did you first start home brewing, Christian?
My first batch was my freshman year of college. My neighbor in the dorm was a home brewer, became best friends, and one day he brought over a bottle of his beer, and I can totally remember the first time I tasted it. I didn't believe that he could actually make his own beer. I hadn't really even heard of home brewing before. So I was like, you got to teach me. And that's when I got started. But the first batch was terrible.
What year was it?
92, my freshman year of college. And so I started with that recipe, and then I remember getting a bunch of friends together, and we were all at this house on campus, and I proudly brought the bottles out, and we cracked them all open, and I really, this is the moment, right? And one of my friends just spat it right over the edge of the porch, just totally lost it. Everyone's kind of half laughing, half awkwardly feeling bad for me. And I was like, oh, is it really that bad? And then I said, yeah, I really missed the mark. But it didn't matter because everyone was like, nice, you made your own beer. The next one's going to be better. And so I just threw myself into it. And sure enough, you know, I improved. I wouldn't say I ever became a serious home brewer. You know, I brewed a bunch of batches. But, you know, there was a big period, a big gap in my knowledge when I opened the brewery that I had to fill in a big way. To make up for a lot of lost time behind the kettles. But that's where the whole dream was born, for sure.
Definitely. So you had that little brief time where you were homebrewing, and then your career took a lot of different directions. You've written books. You're a very accomplished journalist. And when I first met you, I actually knew you as a writer and was surprised that you were opening a brewery. Delighted, though, in fact, because we met in Denver, and you said you were opening it in Newburgh, Oregon. I thought, great, we'll see you right there. So what I was curious about was, once you had actually decided in 2009 that, you know, you wanted to open your own brewery, you have the farmhouse on your heritage land here in Newburgh, Oregon, perfectly situated in wine country, what were the next steps?
Well, that's a good question, and I don't want to go on too long because it's kind of an inside baseball story of land use and permitting and getting things up to code, but the long and short of it is, we had this building, 100 years old, full of romance and history and cobwebs, and there had been a little wine operation in it for a while, so that kind of made me feel like, well, if he can do it, so can I, right? So I went about securing the building, renting it from my folks, and then going to get permits. On a farm, you have to follow certain rules. You can't just do anything you want on a farm. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, every farm that was struggling might build a fast food restaurant or, you know, you never know. So we had to go through those hoops, convince the neighbors, the neighborhood, that it was a good idea to have a farmhouse brewery on our working farm, and that there was a connection between the farm, the farming, and the brewery itself, which we were able to show. So we started, gathering. We got through that phase and then started gathering equipment, testing the water, gathering wild yeast on the trees to figure out, you know, which way we're going to go. So became the beginning of this long, winding road to, basically from an empty agricultural shed with full of squirrels and mice to being what it is now, which is... I wouldn't exactly call it state of the art, but it's a modern brewery. We have the ability to brew in a lot of different styles, and it works great for us. So, but it was not an easy path for sure.
So, did you write a business plan? Did you go get loans and investors? I mean, when did you think from when you started this, when you would open and how you would get this thing off the ground? And what date did you actually open your doors?
Well, we opened in May of 2016, so only 11 months ago from where we are today. Let me go back. We opened in May 2016, but leading up to that point, there was a long, like I said, winding road of making that building work for us. So I had the dream. I had a little bit of money saved up that I invested in the first equipment. So we got the old brew house from a local brewery called Heater Allen, great local brewery, and their first stuff were fermenters. So it was a really exciting day, delivering those out to the farm, bringing them inside, and then plunk, there they are on the ground, but you're still a long way from having a working brewery. We had to upgrade the floors. We had to upgrade the seismic capacity of the walls and roof, the electrical. There was no septic at all. We had to add water system. We had to improve the well line for our own brewing water. I mean, it was just like this crazy laundry list. And I was immediately over my head. So I was out in Denver, and I ran into a guy named Jordan Keeper. He had been head brewer of an amazing brewery called Jester King.
I remember.
Yep. And Jordan and I talked and drank a lot of beer, and discovered we shared some ideas about what a farmhouse brewery can be and what I was trying to do. He was on his own at that point and decided to move up and actually jump in on the project, which was a critical move forward for me. I had so much to learn from him, and he was really excited to get into the startup phase of a brewery. I don't think he was quite ready for how startup it was, but it was great. He made the move up. Then we launched a crowdfunding campaign on a platform called Crowdbrewed. It's like a Kickstarter for the beer world. And we promised people unique beers and some experiences at the farm that, you know, really I felt like couldn't be, you know, common or replicated almost anywhere else. So it was really successful. And overnight we had, practically overnight had a pretty amazing head start on funding. And later, a couple of investors came on board, an old friend and a distant relative, who are now involved in the brewery all the time. So we've really done it by our bootstraps, DIY, done all so much of the work ourselves, and it's still very much a bootstrap operation, but we're getting there.
Awesome. So what do you think has been your biggest obstacle to date in getting the brewery up and running?
Well, I had a lot to learn about, you know, it's one thing to write books about beer and articles and, you know, travel around. I had a really exciting career writing about beer. I supported myself for many years in that way and built a website. And, it was quite exciting. That's a lot different from running a small business day to day, running a production brewery, the ins and outs of coordinating everything. So I would say for me, the learning curve was really steep. I'm not shy about saying that I pretty much got my ass handed to me right off the bat and had to learn to, like I've said, sink or swim, you know, make this work. We had the equipment, we had the vision, we had fans, we had prototype beers that people loved, but we also have to make a replicatable product and get all the operation moving moving forward on a semi-regular basis. So the hard part, I think, for any small brewery is going from dream to reality and putting systems in place, working with others to make all that happen. I was very lucky, though, in that I had Jordan Keeper to begin with. Then he left to be a brewer in Switzerland to work at a brewery called Tuadom. But he's coming back this summer to brew a collab with us, which will be really cool. And then after that, Jake Miller came on board. And Jake had been head brewer of a pilot system for Prairie Artisan Ales in Tulsa, Oklahoma, one of the most important brands in the country, I would say. And Jake was so interested in the project that he quit his job at Prairie to come out and work with me at Wolves and People. So that was another big move forward where Jake believed in the project and saw a great opportunity for himself and came out and then became our opening brewer. Now he's moved on to start his own brewery back in Tulsa, and he's been working in Florida as well. So 6 months ago, I took over production, and I'd say that has not been the hardest moment of the brewery. I think that getting over my own fears and hesitation was the hardest part. Now, running it, I've learned so much from those guys. Coordinating all the recipes, all the ingredients, all the variables is something I truly enjoy. But there's a certain fear of flying, I think, sometimes that you might have. But I might have underestimated how much I learned from those guys. And thankfully, I did. And I feel confident going forward that we're making great beer. And, people are still loving what we're doing. And we're innovating and, still learning and still pushing the envelope.
Well, cheers to good friends and the brewers that helped you out and getting over your fears.
Yeah, absolutely. Cheers to that.
So you mentioned Prairie as being one of the most influential farmhouse breweries. Who else do you find to really be pushing the envelope? Who's inspired you? Which other breweries constantly fascinate you?
Well, right here in Portland, I mean, I always say we're standing on the shoulders of giants because the local beer scene is so incredible. And frankly, I was, pretty intimidated to open a brewery in Oregon. Yeah. I mean, great beer scene. You've got the Commons, pushing the Belgian envelope and upright. Block 15, Degarde. I mean, so many great breweries. Gigantic, doing great beers. Breakside, just crushing across every category. But I didn't so much view those breweries as someone that I was going into competition with, but more those are breweries that I'm inspired by, and I think they all feel the same way about each other. That's one of the greatest things about the industry is there's room for a lot of great breweries. So,
well, most of the people you mentioned we've had on the show and they have said the exact same thing. So I think you're all in good company.
Awesome. But beyond our borders in Oregon, Jester King certainly as a farmhouse brewery using wild yeast, using well water, converting an old farm building. There were very few breweries like that in the country back in 2010-11 when I started getting serious about this idea. I did go out and visit Hill Farmstead and spend a few days with them learning about what they do out in Vermont, another farmhouse brewery that's just amazing in every way. So I look up to breweries like that, and then there's a few in Europe and Belgium that are real farmhouse breweries working on farms that, I had a lot to learn from the way they do things and also the approach to ingredients and flavor profiles. So I'm definitely inspired. I think in the world, it's Belgian breweries for me where I, that's where I truly fell in love with this idea of doing a farmhouse brewery at our farm. You could name a dozen great breweries in Belgium, but there's a few in and around Brussels that I have a real soft spot in my heart for.
So were you able to check out any of the farmhouse breweries in other countries besides Belgium?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a handful across Europe, but I haven't been able to visit a lot of them. I visited rural breweries in Germany, across the Czech Republic. I actually had this crazy experience when I was 21, getting out of college. I won a grant to go study traditional brewing in Europe for a year. It was a crazy year. It was totally, it was one of those experiences. I nothing like it will ever happen in my life. But that's how a lot of my passion for beer was born in that experience. I had a backpack, a little dinky guitar and, you know, some hiking boots, and I went out for a year and visited breweries and started in the UK, and then I spent 3 months in Africa visiting rural breweries in kind of semi-nomadic areas in the south of Niger and Togo. It was a crazy experience. Then I came back to Europe, spent more time in Belgium, Netherlands, Czech Republic, Germany especially. And all along that trip, I was hitting the breweries that had the oldest technology. And that's kind of, in a way, been my thing, is looking at the way people used to make beer, not so we can be like a historical reenactor and, you know, be like the Civil War guys running around, but more like to capture what works for centuries and learn from what we can from that, and then blend it with some modern sensibilities, I think. So some of the breweries I went to in Europe are just totally amazing, unchanged for centuries, still run by the same families. You know, that's definitely the most inspiring thing for me, to stand in a brewery like that and realize, like, the culture, the family, the beer itself, the neighborhood, the area, everything about it has sort of, you know, maintained a kind of character to sustain itself. Mm-hmm. And I think beer is a part of that. You know, beer is a part of the glue of the community. And that's kind of what I want to do with Wolves and People, is be that for my hometown.
So you mentioned, too, when you started Wolves and People, sort of the trepidation of entering such a saturated market and, you know, like how many giants we have just right here. But because it's a real heritage farmhouse on the land you grew up on, and you're employing some of these older tactics and fusing them with modern brewing, I feel like you're offering an experiential brewery that is way different than what a lot of the modern Portland breweries are offering. How has that played in your favor or played against you? Or did you go into it sort of thinking that that was an edge that you would have?
Well, you know, there weren't a lot of breweries in our area when we started out. We're in the middle of wine country in Oregon, so it was 400 wineries within 10 or 20 miles of our place. Wow. But very few breweries, amazingly. But all of my winemaking buddies drink beer. And, you know, I was very excited to see them embrace the brewery, you know. So I kind of hoped that would happen by kind of, if you build it, they will come a little bit. By being a new brewery in wine country, I thought, hopefully people will discover us, and they have. I would say the wine world has been a big part of our success so far. People coming to the brewery after work, during harvest. You know, we made a beer for the wine industry called Crush Pad, and Crush Pad is the place in a winery where the grapes are crushed during harvest. So we are like, let's make a beer that's crushable and, you know, relates to the Crush Pad. And we had a party and invited all the winemakers we know. And for the rest of harvest, all those interns, winemakers were coming to the brewery regularly. So that was really cool. So I had a hunch that might be a good thing. As far as, you know, differentiating ourselves from Portland, or, you know, I don't know that I, you know, wanted to sort of put a stamp on what we're doing and say we're different from an inner city brewery in some way, because every brewery has its own draw, from the brewer to the beers themselves to what's going on in and around the neighborhood. I will say this, like, if you come to Wolves and People, what people discover is an orchard. You're sitting in our hazelnut orchard, and it's right in front of you. We couldn't be closer to it, and you're sitting next to the barn, which is a century old. And there's a certain magic in that for us when we're just hanging out there, but I think customers pick up on that. And now we can have families too, so it's really cool when little kids are running around, and it makes me feel like a kid again, you know, to see them cruising around and having fun, and their parents are kicking back and having a beer. It's about the mellowest beer scene out there, I would say, but, you know, that's one of the reasons we love it. So.
Right. Well, and it's just such a great story in terms of, you know, full circle. You know, this is the land that you grew up on. I remember visiting you out there in the very early stages, and your parents just sort of wandered down and said hello, and it was very cute. We were living in a little cottage and fixing up the farmhouse. And one of the things that I recall most clearly was the art installation in the attic of the farmhouse. Is that still there? Is that accessible to people who visit the brewery?
Yeah, you know, art is a huge part of what we do. And everything that we've done from the start, from reaching out to our now our graphic artist, who is sort of on staff as a retainer, Jason Sturgill, designed all these beautiful labels here, to the art that's on the walls and this piece in the attic, we really feel like art should be an important part of the brewery. I studied a lot of art in college, and my mother's a painter, and so we wanted that to be a part of the experience as well. The sculpture in the attic is kind of inaccessible right now. We run up there every once in a while, but the project right now is to add a cool ship up there, which is a big shell open fermenter for spontaneous beers, and then use the room below it for aging those beers. But as much as we can, we want to share that room with anyone who anyone we can, but it's we're just not quite, it's not quite the prime time yet. We have to do a lot of improvements to the building to make it public, per se. But when it comes to inspiration, you know, the artwork that friends have done for us, the artworks that are done for our labels by Jason, I'd say it's a huge part of what we do. We spend a lot of time thinking about it and enjoying that process, honestly. So the farm where Wolves and People is located is called Springbrook Farm. It's 21 miles outside of Portland, and my four older brothers and I grew up there. My parents moved there in the 60s, 67, to farm filberts. Or we say we grow filberts, but we sell hazelnuts, which is like the marketing-friendly term. But it's a working hazelnut farm, and an amazing place to grow up, for sure. I was very lucky. But this game that we played growing up was called Wolves and People. And the idea was, you know, someone would be elected the wolf and go across the farm, the yard somewhere, and all the rest of the people had to chase and get to the other side, and, you know, without getting tagged by the wolf. And if you got tagged by the wolf, you became a wolf. Super fun. My nieces and nephews still play it. And so when I was thinking about the name of the brewery, like, what could it be? Should I name it after the farm? Should I name it after my hometown? I don't know. And a cousin of mine said, you should name it Wolves and People. And I just realized, like, it's exactly right. That is, says so much about the way we grew up out there, about the way people are in general. You know, there's, you know, and a great story about this is I was buying a sink from a contractor one day, an old steel sink, and we met in a parking lot out in the suburbs somewhere, and we're getting this heavy sink out and putting it in my truck, and he's like, huh, interesting name for your brewery. I was like, oh, thanks, you know, and I thought he was kind of making fun of me, right? And he goes, no, really, we all know where we'll fit in, right? And I was like, you get it, man. So you're on the spectrum, right? Somewhere,
yes.
Somewhere you're a little more wolf or a little more person. But anyway, it was super cool that he picked up on that right away. It was one of those early moments when I realized, like, okay, people are going to get this. It's not too weird. It's a little weird. It's not too weird, hopefully.
So do you, you're talking a lot about, like, you know, how, what kind of balance you want to strike between that wildness and between, you know, being thoughtful and intentional. Do you have or have you developed a specific philosophy to your brewery, to your business over the years? Did you start with one or did one grow inside of you over your experience?
That's a good question. I mean, I would say I'm still learning every day about, like, how to run a business. Also brewing, we're learning all the time, trying new things. You know, there's a certain, a lot of people ask me, like, what is farmhouse brewing or what is Saison? Which is one of the styles we're drinking. All three of these beers are really Saison beers in some way or another. This is a blend of a Saison and a Belgian Pale Ale. Saison. And the answer is pretty subtle in a way that, you know, there isn't a very hard and fast definition. It allows for some creativity, for playing with ingredients that are coming to us by virtue of the season. Like, so when the figs are ripe at the farm, we're going to brew a Saison with it. When the plums are ripe, we're going to throw them in a barrel and age on it. Mm-hmm. You know, when things come around through the natural cycle of life, we're going to incorporate that in the brewery. Now, from a business perspective, that's a little bit of an esoteric way to do business, because you can't say, well, we don't know when the figs are going to be ripe this year. We don't know when the blackberries are going to peak. We don't know when the plums are going to be just fat and hanging on the tree. We have to kind of go with the flow a little bit. So I would say that farmhouse brewing, Saison brewing, lends itself to a little bit of creativity, some openness, some lassitude, some improvisation. And we're constantly doing that in the brewery. Like, you know, we're not just winging it, but hey, you know what? I'm out of this hop. I think I'm going to try this one. So in a new beer the other day I was brewing, I was like, you know what? The hop I wanted to reach for, I forgot. I hadn't tracked it down. I used a different hop from southern France. from northern France, and it was it ended up being really interesting in the beer. And I think that's kind of where we find a lot of room to play and improvise, you know, within the strictures. But there's certain laws of brewing you can't change, you know, but there's a lot that you can work within to experiment and find new flavors, new ways of expressing hops, malt, water, yeast. All those things are coming out in different ways.
So maybe improvisation and openness to creativity and spontaneity might be sort of a guiding philosophy?
I would say that, absolutely. And, you know, we have farmers who come in from the area. They know about our farm from growing up. And the other day, a woman stopped by and said, "Hey, I grew up on Parrot Mountain. We have elderberry. We have this, that, and the other berry. Are you interested in those fruits?" And absolutely. You know, just by her coming by, we forged a friendship. It turned out she had been to our farm as a kid, and, you know, we didn't know each other then. We were tiny little children running around with our parents and stuff, right? But she's like, "Oh, yeah, I came here as a kid to an Easter party or something." So now she's going to be bringing us, like, elderberries and all these, you know, cool things that we can use. So we're open to that. A lot of breweries, unfortunately, maybe they're making their flagship beers over and over again. Maybe every tank has stout, IPA, double IPA, and Pilsner in it or something. We are reserving a tank almost always for those experiments. So our tank one is pretty much an open vessel whenever we can have it open for those beers as they come along. So we're trying to maintain that culture of, you know, we're open to these things as they come. We're kind of thinking ahead. When are cherries ripe? When's rhubarb coming back? When's the plum coming? You can't necessarily put it on the calendar. And from running a business, there's certain things you have to put on the calendar, first of the month, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to build and plan for that.
So is the use of, like, figs, your own figs, cherries, plums, and that kind of thing kind of connected to what you were talking about earlier about communicating to your neighbors the relevancy of a brewery and a farm together?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely try to tell that story so they know that our well water comes from directly beneath the farm. Obviously, we're going to take care of the land. Our well water will be healthy, too. A lot of the wild yeast we use comes off of plums, you know, blackberries, figs, you name it, that's going right in the beer. We grow some hops. They're not amazing, but, you know, we're going to get better. Peaches, apricots, figs, all those things are growing on the property now, and we're trying to grow more of them. So, I think people who visit pick up on that and realize, hey, they're actually trying to use things from the farm. We're not just, you know, calling in an order to some factory, 18-wheeler pulls up and drops off flats of peaches or something. No, we get them from a farmer down the road in Canby. And you know, that's amazing to us, like, that we can make those relationships. And they know us, and they want to try the beer when it's done, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and that's super cool. You get to try their fruit when they bring it in. Hey, this is, oh, nice, really good. You know, we'll take as much as we can get. That's just such a pleasure to be able to do that. And I think our neighbors are picking up on it, too.
So, Christian, when you walk from your farmhouse brewery across the way to your cottage, what's in your fridge? What do you like to drink at the end of the day? Is there do you tend towards wine because you've been tasting beer all day? Or do you have a quaffable lager that is your go-to?
Oh, that's a good question. Fortunately, brewers are really generous, and when they visit us, they bring beer. So I have a pretty steady selection of beers to try. Someone brought me a beer the other day from Mars Brewery, M-A-H-R-S. It is a brewery in Germany, in Franconia, which is actually where the town of Newburgh, Oregon, was named for a town over in that region. But somebody brought me this beer, and it's like a classic old school German lager. I mean, I love Pilsners. Like, frankly, if I'm drinking anything after work, I love wine, but I love a great Pilsner. A great, you know, Helles beer, light, crisp, clean, kind of. Those are the beers that I'm reaching for after work, generally.
All right. Top three favorite Pilsners. Go.
Whoa. Oh, gosh. No. Too much pressure. Number one. Yeah. Heater Allen from McMinnville, Oregon. Fantastic beer. Great family friends. We wouldn't be in business without them. I'm going to say Victory Prima Pilsner from Downington, Pennsylvania. One of the breakthrough Pilsners of all time. And it's really hard to say this, I'm going to say, can I have a tie?
Yes.
Mars Ungespundet Hefetrub, which is a unfiltered Pilsner from Franconia. Badass beer. And the other one I would have to say is Pivo from Firestone Walker. Just an incredible beer. Every brewer looks up to that beer. Man, I could name another 20 that I love, but those are three. Those are four, actually, that are great.
Christian, thank you so much for coming on the show today. And cheers to the wolves and the people in all of us.
Cheers.
Cheers. Thank you.